Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you Sword and Sandal Cinema. And we'll be starting with the one, the only Michael Del Rossi, a friend and fellow Olympian. Greetings and welcome, Michael. How are you tonight?
Thrilled to be with you. Always look forward to our Tuesday get-togethers.
As do I.
It's just great to be here. Yes, thank you so much.
Go ahead.
I would just like to, as we usually do, before we get into anything else, I'd like to share our workout updates, if I can. I know I always like to hear how you're moving forward with your training and what ideas you have, and I like to share workout techniques. So before we get into the depth of what we wanted to share, I'd like to hear how your workouts have been going the past month.
I injured my shoulder again, which is the most common place that I experience injury repeatedly. So mm-hmm. I cut back a little bit on the different items that I use for exercise. So I'm still mm-hmm. using kettlebells and toning rings and hand grips and mm-hmm. kettlebells and but I'm sticking the poundages low when I exercise my shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
I continue doing meditation twice a day when I get up and mm-hmm. before I go to bed. And I've mm-hmm. continued with my energy work.
That's something I really want to share with you at some future
okay.
time. Yes, I really want to hear about that.
And making energy balls is becoming a lot easier. Generating heat is becoming a lot easier. So although, mm-hmm. again, I'm not up to par with where I once was, I'm getting there slowly. Mm-hmm. So I will continue on with that. And I have been, again, continuing experimentation with my diet and with supplementation. Mm-hmm. So tomorrow I begin a new phase with that. And I'm going to be excluding a particular food that I don't know if it's causing me problems with my sugar. I don't know if it's causing me other problems. So I will be removing it and see what happens. And the thing with diabetes and other sugar, blood sugar diseases is they change on you. So just when you think you have it figured out, it's something different. Mm-hmm. And you need to do something different. And it's back mm-hmm. to the drawing board. But that's, again, that's, it could be considered a bad thing or it could be considered a good thing. So I prefer to look at it as a blessing in a way because I have to continuously monitor that rather than just habitually living with something and not knowing if it does me good or ill.
Well, it's interesting you should say that. I agree with you. If it does anything, whenever we're dealing with a health or physical challenge of some kind, it certainly heightens our powers of discipline, if you will, and our powers to adjust to change. So I understand what you're saying there. Have you added the berberine at all to your program? And
yes,
if you have,
I've added berberine, and mm-hmm. I took it daily for a while, for over a month,
mm-hmm.
and now I'm taking mm-hmm. it like four or five times a week to see if there is some change. There might mm-hmm. be some change because some of mm-hmm. the areas that berberine addresses, have not been as good as they were when I was taking the berberine every day. So one of the things I'm mm-hmm. going to be taking berberine again daily.
Mm-hmm.
There were some other things I was using with the berberine while I was researching the berberine, but I don't have the bottles in front of me, so I'm not remembering mm-hmm. the names. One of them was something and had aloe vera to help it, so I was taking that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taking bitter melon.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice any results with the bitter melon as an addition?
I feel better. But mm-hmm. tomorrow I'm going to start measuring my blood again. That's another mm-hmm. change for tomorrow. And mm-hmm. let's see what the numbers say.
Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing adventure, to be sure.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And I guess, and as you pointed out, in some ways, that's how way we have to look at it. I've been dealing with severe arthritis in both my shoulders, Ooh. Which really began to manifest fully this year. And when I had my CT scan of my chest, they pointed out that it's a form of arthritis where the cartilage is literally disintegrating. But you know, I'm learning to when you love training, you find a way to work around these things and keep on going. So I'm still doing laterals, but with very light weights. Bands seem to help. I'm
yes.
enjoying the band because I don't know what it is, and I'm interested to get your viewpoint on this. But you do get a fantastic pump when you're training with bands. Yes, go ahead.
I can sympathize with your arthritis. Athena's going through some of that in her hands.
Really?
It's been pretty bad lately, so she's mm-hmm. experimenting too with different things. And bands, mm-hmm. I've always had good experiences with bands. I have a wide assortment of them. Right now I'm keeping most of them in the basement in a plastic box, mm-hmm. but I've taken a couple mm-hmm. of them out and I use them during my workouts. It does give you a better mm-hmm. pump in some ways than the free weights or the kettlebells. I think it gives you like a different range of motion.
Mm-hmm. Well, they really do. They really do. I've noticed it myself that I'm actually enjoying the pump that I'm experiencing more with the bands. And it seems to not inflame my injuries as much. I like the bands. The Bullworker, too, I would suggest, because I'm experimenting also as far as the arthritis, Athena might want to consider trying collagen peptides. I've gotten some collagen peptides from Life Extension. I believe it's collagen number 1 and 3, they say, are the most effective. I think it's mostly from chicken, and I think beef as well. I'm not sure. But some of the research I've viewed seemed to be very positive in terms of utilizing collagen peptides for arthritic conditions on a regular basis, along with the glucosamine sulfate and MSM. So I've combined everything and have tried that. She may want to consider adding collagen peptides to see how that if that has any positive effect on her condition.
I have collagen peptides and I have MSM. So mm-hmm. if she wants to experiment, I'll tell her about it tonight.
Mm-hmm.
So glucosamine, it depends on the source. She has a shellfish allergy. So some of the sources for glucosamine are from shellfish. So that wouldn't be very good.
Yes. No, not at all. No. You know, the research is always unfolding and ongoing. So, you know, we try to keep up with it the best that we can. Bromelain is another thing I've tried for years. It's been touted as being very effective when it comes to muscle sprains, some joint pain. Research has indicated that many football players have added it to their program to deal with injuries. So I'm taking 2 tablets a day, again, from Life Extension. I don't know that I've noticed any change yet, but I'm probably going to continue with the program and see what happens. You know, it's an adventure. It's an adventure like anything else. So we experiment, and it's always better, of course, to try to utilize natural therapies because I think the body responds in a healthier way, you know. Occasionally, we do have to resort to conventional medications. But if we can treat some of these things, which especially, I think adding collagen to your dietary program might be very effective, even beyond arthritic conditions. I think the body loses collagen very rapidly, makes much less as we get older. And we know that vitamin C can help the body remanufacture collagen. But from what I've seen so far in terms of examining the research, I think it might be beneficial to, in terms of preventing other diseases as well, but I'll certainly keep looking at that and see what unfolds. But I certainly can understand what she's going through because it's painful and it's a challenge.
But again, we are fortunate to live in a time when there are many, many options that we can explore and experiment with.
Absolutely, and we do have that. We do have that available to us, and I certainly am grateful for that. That we can be our own nutritionists. To the limits that we're able.
And our own neurobiologists and our own, you know, all sorts of things.
Well, it's true because I was just speaking to a former schoolmate, a big guy. We used to train together. He's living in Florida now. And we were both sharing that philosophy that at the end of the day, no matter what it says on the back of a bottle, no matter what the studies may show, at the end, it's our day-to-day results or lack of it that's going to tell us what direction to go in terms of our health and trying to make things better as we age. It's important to examine the latest studies as well if we can do that. But at the end of the day, we're our own doctors and our own researchers. So I completely agree with that.
Sure.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say.
No, I was just going to say that it's good that we have this platform, too, to share this information because we're putting together a conversation just on this, so we get a chance to really talk about it and explore it, whereas otherwise it's easy to get unfocused because of the transitions that happen in everyday life and all the different events that are continuously bombarding us.
You know, the great thing is you've provided all of us with an outlet, and it's so exciting what you just said that, you know, something we're sharing may help a listener, may help someone who's dealing with some of the same challenges that we are. And certainly some of the nutritional research, which I think is so vitally important. And the reality is you probably won't hear in your doctor's office. You probably won't hear about the latest research concerning collagen. You're unlikely to hear about the latest research concerning bromelain or the latest research on glucosamine or MSM. In all likelihood, you probably won't hear this information from your primary care physician, if you will. So this is one of the exciting things about having an outlet like this, that what we're going through, the challenges that we're confronting and dealing with from a nutritional standpoint, someone out there may decide to experiment and try some of the substances that we're discussing and probably may not hear about it anywhere else. So it's indeed exciting from that standpoint as well that we can help someone out there. I'm sure we are.
Indeed it is. And I've made many wonderful friends over the course of this audio adventure, including yourself. And that wouldn't have happened if we weren't on this journey. And I'm glad we connected as easily and as early as we did and that our conversation continues.
Yeah, but I can honestly say the most exciting thing to happen in my life is to discover Hercules Invictus and this wonderful program and outlet and share some of this information that I have been called to share, the desire to share what I have learned over the last 35 years with an audience, broader audience, as opposed to do one-on-one consulting. So for me, it's been a great calling and a great blessing just to be able to do this.
Well, thank
what
you.
I would
that
like
means,
to share,
means a lot to me.
Yes. Absolutely. And what I'd like to share tonight is what I feel is the transformative power of sword and sandal. It's a very, a very, powerful reflection, if you will, in terms of the era we grew up in. And as always, I call it When the Gods Touch the Earth. I don't think anything in cinematic history really can compare to the major personal impact that Sword and Sandal has had on the generation and beyond, from the standpoint of enhancing the inner universe, if you will. They encourage young people beyond the conventional world to the sky, to the stars, to search for something more. I was reading Joseph Campbell had an interesting comment. He said, the call to adventure signifies that destiny has summoned the hero within us. And he emphasized that, the hero within us. And another gentleman, I don't know, you probably will be familiar with him. I've just discovered him. Have you heard of an author by the name of Rick Rodan?
Yes. I have all the Greek mythology books. I've read through most of them. I read through the original Percy Jackson and the second series of Percy Jackson. I haven't read the Apollo books yet or the new – they just published a new book earlier this year in the Percy Jackson world. I used to have the Egyptian and the Norse worlds as well. But I wasn't really getting into them, so I gave them to my wife to put on eBay.
Mm-hmm. I have just discovered him. I did not know he or his work existed until recently. How did you enjoy his novels concerning, the Greek mythology, the Greek myths, if you will? I don't know much about it.
Which books have you read?
None.
Oh.
None. Nothing. I just came upon him, and I noticed that he was evidently he's tying the Greek heroes into modern day figures, if you will. He's tying them into this is what I'm getting from it so far. So what am I missing, and what can you give me on this?
Well, basically, he took mythology, Greek mythology, Norse mythology, Egyptian mythology, and I'll stick to the Greek for now. He did series of books, and each series had, I believe, like 5 books in it, and they've been since translated, some of them to games, the first 2 books into movies, and they're working on Amazon is working on a new series that's going to reboot the whole thing. And it's about Chiron's academy, which is an academy for heroes. And he developed the book because his son had dyslexia. So he tried to make dyslexia a superpower, a mythical heroic power. And that's how it started. So he used to tell his son stories, and then he wrote the stories down. He was an author of children's books, so he wrote one, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. And then it goes on from there. I have some of the books in the duplicate because I used to give them out to kids when I did events for kids. So let me look to see what I have. And if you want them, they're yours. I'll mail them to you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I was just curious if I had a feeling that you were already familiar with him and his work. But I just wanted to ask you about him because what I read today sounded very interesting. But before today, believe it or not, I knew nothing about him. The reason he grabbed my interest is I came upon a quote from him. He said, being a hero doesn't mean you're invincible. It just means that you're brave enough to stand up and do what's needed. I like that quote. And so then I went on to read about it. Yes. And I discovered, that he was involved in the Greek myths somehow. So beyond that, and somehow tying modern-day figures into his work. That's all I knew. But
in the first story, somebody steals, I believe, Zeus's thunderbolt. And Percy Jackson is the son of Poseidon. And the big three in Greek mythology don't usually have children that much anymore because the world was a very chaotic place when they did in mythical times. So you know, it's a, and Percy Jackson somehow gets blamed for it, or he's tied into it somehow, and they go on a road trip across the United States and meet with different mythical figures, and the movie and the game are slightly different. And then there's a graphic novel, which is like a comic book but thicker, and again, it's a very interesting thing. They have that the monsters kind of respawn, like in a video game. So if you defeat a monster, the monster will eventually come back, but it's just off the earth for now. And of course, like in Greek mythology, there are the different realms, and the gods are, you know, very much a complex personalities, and yet still very much who they were in antiquity. I believe that they have you can access Olympus through the Empire State Building, I believe, or the tall building. So it was a lot of fun. It was very enjoyable. Now that I have more, now that I have more time to read, I've taken them off the shelf, and I'm planning on going through them, and I've picked up the first book. So I still have all the Greco-Roman stuff. So I'm going to start with that and see where it goes. But I enjoyed it a great deal.
Well, yeah, it was his quote that really garnered my attention. And then, of course, I read about what else he was writing. And it was the Greek myths that I was most interested in. So I was pretty sure you might have been familiar with it, but I thought I'd ask you about it. For those of us who were thrilled by the exploits and the nature of Greek heroes specifically, I think somehow the whispers from Mount Olympus told us that we would never be completely alone. It's the way I felt when I was going to school, and I was so enamored by the sword and sandal, genre of that time. I think the spirit, you know, that spirit will, for me, will always be with us. And when that spirit is with those heroes, I feel like you're never really alone. Those heroes have become so much a part of me. Those films have become so much a part of me that when I'm going through a tough time and I think of those films and think of those heroes, I realize that you want to shout Olympia as Hercules did
in the
cartoons. Remember the cartoons? And you know what? You want to shout Olympia.
Yes,
and because that spirit,
lovely Elena and Newton and Toot and the prince. I forget what the prince's name was.
I forget the prince's name too, but you know,
Caledon.
There's such a wonderful energy about it all. And so for those of us who grew up with these films, I remain convinced that there was never anything like it in cinematic history. I don't believe there'll ever be anything quite like it again. The Greek heroes, the spirit of it, the mythology, all of it provided an inner strength. And that's what the sword and sandal cinema did for me. And even now, at 71 years old, they continue to do exactly that. So for me, it was a transformative power, if you will, in my life. And I hope it's also that for others who take the time to see these films and be exposed to them and the adventure that they provide.
I had developed many years ago a course. It was called the Centaur's Cave, and sometimes called Chiron's Cave, and it was about the Olympian heroic path and how we can align ourselves more with Olympus and bring Olympus more to this world. So I'm thinking of doing that again. And on either a podcast or on a Zoom show, I haven't decided where, but you'll definitely be a frequent guest on that one.
That would certainly be exciting. And I think it would uplift the spirits of many. So I'd be certainly looking forward to that.
And I started with kids decades ago. I do interactive storytelling with them where they they can be any Greek hero they want, or they can make up one of their own. And then they have adventures. They go up to the Golden Fleece. They go to the Labyrinth of the Minotaur. They go after the Caledonian Boar, you know, or, you know, whatever adventures there are to go into. And the kids really love that. They love the using their imagination and putting themselves in situations that they're not likely to encounter except metaphorically in our world. So that's a very popular one of the things that I do. And our groups and our conversations, we have, I think, 5 or 6 Sword and Sandal cinema shows. And then we have, just on Facebook alone, we have over 30,000 members in our Sword and Sandal cinema groups. So the world does remember and honor these stories, and it's a good thing that we're the keepers of these tales, because they had a very powerful effect on us and other people as well. Because when I first started my Age of Heroes initiatives in New York, the story was Jason and the Argonauts, and most people had exposure to that story not through books or not through Greek school or not through or comics even, but through the movies. And they'd seen one of the versions of Jason the Argonauts, and they wanted to be an Argonaut. So that was my whole recruiting thing, you know. Let's do something. Let's go after a golden fleece for the world and contribute something to our world. And now it's here in my hometown, too. You know, people are becoming Argonauts, and we're going to pick something and try to find a solution to it. And even though it'll be local, not all the people are local. They can do it in their community. It will help them out, and, you know, maybe get this initiative, whatever initiative we finally pick, you know, make some positive change in the world.
Well, that's, you know, to open up their imaginations. And that's what you're doing, to open up their imaginations to all possibilities. And I think that's what the Greek myths do. I don't know of anything else as rich and in depth as the Greek myths. I myself, even at this stage of my life, I'm still learning. I'm still learning and researching. And there's so much richness and so much color to the Greek myths that, you know, you're whole spirit, your spirit is revitalized, if you will. And for young people, it's certainly an adventure like no other. So I'm excited to hear that you're doing all of that.
And I'm glad that you're somebody who sees that too, because we're a minority, the people who, you know, were really influenced in a positive way by the mythical movies that we grew up with. And I'm glad that there's enough of us to at least form a community and have shows and be doing things, because it's a wonderful thing. And it's those that it's touched have been changed by it and are still fueled by it and motivated by it.
Absolutely. You know, the great messages are all there. The golden rule, good versus evil, magic, the magic of the spirit, the magic of imagination. It's all there for the young people today. And all they have to do is look at it, take an interest in it, and expose themselves to it. And that's what you're doing for the young people here, to learn about the Greek, fabulous Greek myths, is just priceless as far as I'm concerned.
And the time has gotten away from us again, my friend. It's a minute more of your time. How can people get in contact with you? And people benefit from your ministry, which encompasses all of
these? They can write to me at Michael DeRussi, Box 129, Caldwell, New Jersey, 07009. I have a prayer ministry. I work with White Light. They can write to me, write their prayers down. I'll write them back, and we will do very strong, focused prayer. I've just received some testimonies that really excited me and really made my week, and I'll share that on the next program. And I also have a wellness program, Creative Health Manual, which provides a firm foundation for holistic healing and for holistic health. And they can order that from me if they will. and I'll explain that on a future program.
Awesome, and I will invite you to whatever groups I started setting up. Right now, I haven't had a lot of time to develop them, but they're there. So I'll invite you to any that I've set up so far.
All right. Thank you so much. It's been really fun. It's been exciting, as always.
Ditto here, and be well, my friend. I'll talk to you. I'll give you a call this week.
Thank you, my friend. Be well.
Be well. And now we move to part two of this program with Setna of Kemet, who will be reviewing a movie about ancient Egypt. Greetings.
Hello.
I'm Setna. How are you?
Greetings. For 2 seconds, I lost you there. I don't know what happened.
I clicked the wrong button.
Tonight,
that's what happened. And I corrected.
Tonight, I'm giving great honor. This is a movie called The Land of the Pharaohs, which has some accuracies and some very funny inaccuracies. It is about the pharaoh Khufu, who is also called Cheops, and his building of the first pyramid, who was actually built by his son for him. And it goes on and on. It's a great movie. This is the first film that we ever get to see the incredibly beautiful Joan Collins. She plays a character who rises up from being a servant girl to a second queen. Her name is Melissa. Joan Collins was only 16 years old when she did this film. She lied. She told them she was much older. She wore a lot of makeup. And she came from London to Hollywood to do this. This is a Howard Hawks production, massive, on the same scale as the great Ten Commandments that, of course, Cecil B. DeMille did.
Mm-hmm.
Several years later. What's really wonderful is a lot of this film is actually filmed in Saqqara, which is where the great pyramid, well, where the original pyramid was. A lot of it's filmed in Egypt. They use hundreds and hundreds of Egyptian extras, and you can see it's hot as hell there. But the people are happy. I guess they're getting paid, whatever. But they're really enjoying this movie. The costumes are funny. They're, you know, Hollywood version of ancient Egyptian, except everybody, all the guys are wearing long loincloths or robes and things. The rest of it is glamorous as hell. Everybody's in sequins and fine silks and jewels. And it says that the pharaoh Khufu went on all these battles to gather up gold and treasure and stuff to hide in the pyramid. And what happens is they find this quote-unquote Kushite architect who builds the pyramid for him, which, as we all know, is horribly inaccurate. The architect's name is Imhotep. He is the very first true architect from Egypt.
Uh-huh.
Imhotep is an amazing being. He built this pyramid. He's also famous for being a great doctor. I don't want to get you mad, Hercules, but he's really the father of medicine, not Hippocrates. In fact, Hippocrates studied in Alexandria to bring ancient Egyptian medicine to Western world. Don't be so mad at me, but that's true. Well, you know, they go on and on about the Hippocratic Oath, and to me it should be an oath honoring Imhotep. He was a wonderful, brilliant man. He learned how to set bones. A lot of the people working on these pyramids got hurt. I mean, you're carrying million-pound stones, you know, tons and tons of stuff, and people got hurt. So he learned how to set bones. He worked on lacerations. He used honey. He used things, medical things that we're doing even now. He was also a dentist. He had all kinds of gold fillings and braces and such. So that's kind of amazing. But getting back to the movie... Getting back to the movie, a lot of these things that I'm looking at are accurate. You have people who are not slaves. These are farmers, merchants, all kinds of people in Egypt who stopped what they were doing for their season, after the growing season, to build these pyramids. And that's true. And that's amazing. They knew this. This movie was made in the 50s. Joan Collins was gorgeous. The late 50s. She's gorgeous, And there are parts of this thing that are laughable. There's a scene where she's going to kill off the new queen, the other Cheops, Khufu's wife, and she uses a snake with a flute. Now, we all know snakes are deaf, okay? So supposedly the little boy is playing the flute, and the mother sees the snake coming toward her and throws herself on her son to stop the snake from biting the son. Well, snakes can't hear.
People do play the pipes and the snakes seem to dance.
Well, because they're following the movement of the flute. When I was in India many years ago, I asked, long before I knew snakes were deaf, and I've had pet snakes, I have. I once had a 13-foot python, Hercules.
Wow.
And we know your hero, Hercules, was fighting pythons, too, and poisonous snakes in the cradle, right?
Yes.
The great Hercules did that. Well, anyway, I bought this beautiful snake in Florida, and she was, 12 inches long. And in about 5 years, she was 13 and a half feet long.
Wow.
And I did several plays, and she was in bank commercials. She's even seen with Elvira wearing her on a card called Fangs for the Mammaries. And you can tell where the snake was. And, you know, that's cool.
I can guess.
The
Barnett
Barnett Bank commercial happened because they were doing the temple. What was it? Either Temple of Doom or the Lost Ark, and they needed snakes, and they wanted to have a friendly snake because, you know, snakes can be nasty. And they wanted to have a friendly snake chasing the guy that they had dressed as Indiana Jones. So I brought Pi, my python, to them, and she was a big hit. They used her in several of the commercials and made her work for her mice. And I also used her. I was in a play where I played Reverend Zeke in Florida for the Florida Playwright Foundation. I'm going to give them a plug. And I was Reverend Zeke, and he's actually the devil. And I was a long red satin robe, and I was wrapped with my python. So that was kind of cool. The snake was in the play. She behaved herself very well. There was no rats in the audience, you know, that I knew of, except maybe the critics. And it was a great success. We did a lot of work. We did, I think, 13 weeks in different places. We traveled Florida with that. And the snake went everywhere I went. And there were, you know, days where I couldn't take her out of her tank because she was hungry. And, you know, they get, like everybody else, they get grumpy when they, you know, when they're hungry. So I put her away so she didn't bite somebody, because she would have. That was the one thing about her. When she was in a bad mood, you left her alone. Kind of like, you know, most husbands or wives, right? So getting back to Land of the Pharaohs. So now I'm watching this, and the Pharaoh has just gotten this guy, this Cushite, Bashta, to be the builder of the pyramid. And he's telling all the people in the lords and ladies and what have you in the court that not only is he going into this tomb, but the chief lords and ladies, his harem, his architects, his ministers, the high priests, and they're all being buried with him. Now, in later times in Egypt, they put statues like they did in China with the emperor, with all the little soldiers. But it's true that in Egypt, as in Babylonia, and in Samaria and all the Asian, Middle Eastern and Asian cultures, as well as the Western African cultures, when a king died, the entire royal court went with him. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that as a fact. I've heard of it, but I believe that part of it was fictional. Not that people weren't buried with him, but I didn't believe it was his whole court.
Well, they uncovered in Iraq, before the whole nonsense happened with Iran and Iraq, one of the tombs of one of the kings. Now, I don't think it was Nebuchadnezzar, but it was someone in that family. And there were 97 other bodies buried with that king. There was his wife, One of the younger sons, the older son, became king. But there were ministers. There was his harem. That was 42 women that he, you know, he kind of said, you come in with me. Ministers, grand viziers, the head of the military, all these people were all found with their, they were all skeletons. They weren't mummified, but they were all found in the tomb around the sarcophagus of the king.
Were they anesthetized before being placed in the tomb, or they were just escorted in and that was it?
Some of them were poisoned. Some of them were strangled.
Oh, okay.
Nobody went willingly, believe me. I'm watching the film now. The pharaoh is coming off his throne. Joan Collins has just come in, and she's wearing this long, flowing robe. This is the part which the censors had a heart attack with. And you know why?
Why?
This is the first time in the history of Hollywood, in color anyway, that Joan Collins, her navel is showing, and her accoutrement are rather large, and everything is seen. The censors were horrified because her the lower part of her costume, her gown, showed her belly button. And no one has ever seen a belly button in Hollywood yet. Although, I want to say something about that.
Okay.
Busby Berkeley had all those extravaganzas in black and white. And many of those girls were naked. And Theda Vera as Cleopatra was, you know, she had a metal brassiere on, but she was pretty much fairly well naked as well. So I don't know where the censors had, maybe there weren't censors yet, but now there were censors watching these things, and they were very upset because Joan Collins' belly button was showing. So they stuck a ruby in it.
Post-production?
No, they had to stop production. The Hollywood censors came to the set and said, her belly button's showing. You can't do that. Meanwhile, there's all these naked men running around wearing, you know, little robes and loincloths and what have you. That was okay, but a woman's belly button was forbidden. I'm looking now even at the scene, and there are about five guys that are naked from the waist up. Joan Collins is now being whipped. And, you know, you're seeing the whip on the back. So this is kind of an interesting thing. This man, this pharaoh who's being so cruel, is very attracted to her because she's beautiful. The truth of the matter is that Khufu, Cheops, was a very cruel ruler. There's only one tiny little image of him. It's about a 1.5-inch statue in the museum in Cairo. And it's... He looks like Hervé Villechaize. He's a tiny little man. And they found villages where the pyramids were built, where the people that lived there, you know, worked, built there. And it's said that it was very badly thought of. This pharaoh was cruel and awful and did not treat the people well. So this part of this is true, that this pharaoh, this Cheops, Khufu, was a very nasty person. The rest of this is pure Hollywood, you know, fluff, where he's falling in love with this beautiful, gorgeous young woman, and it goes on and on. And she's very ambitious. The character, this story is a moralist thing. She's ambitious. He's building a pyramid to, you know, hoard all his gold and treasures and jewels. And she sees some of them later on in the film. And she wants them. She thinks it's horrible that all this treasure is going to be buried with him. So she, you know, she gets him and she gets him all excited. And he marries her. He marries her after she kills his first wife. And it goes on in the pyramid, you know, the construction. They see various scenes of construction. I'm very happy with production, a lot of the production value. But it's very interesting. A lot of the pieces you see are replicas from the tomb of King Tut. However, there's also green and turquoise tiles on the walls. And if you go to New York to the Metropolitan Museum, you will see from pieces of the palace that they found of Khufu, actual tiles like this. So this is accurate. And, you know, for a Hollywood, you know, kind of sword and sandals funny thing, there are a great deal of accuracies in this film. Does that surprise you, Hercules?
No, it does not, because they were on location. So I'm assuming that they took advantage of the fact they're on location to add some realism to the movie.
It really does. I think that the character, the Pharaoh, his costumes are ludicrous because some of them are not accurate. You know, one, he's wearing a collar now that looks like shoulder pads. Joan Collins was the queen of shoulder pads, so this is perfect for her. But they're going to show the king, the Pharaoh, now wrestling a bull. Now, you know, that's Atlantis, Aquitiri, that's Minoan. They were the ones that fought the bulls. Egyptian pharaohs never did this. This is kind of silly. So they're all standing behind what looks like a Texas corral, and the bull just gored the Pharaoh really badly. He's crying very hard, and there's like 10 other heroes now holding this bull down while the Pharaoh is trying to, you know, stop him. He has the bull by the horns, as it were. And this is a lot of bull, I think. But they never did anything like this. This is kind of silly. And you can tell that there are Texas Wranglers in Egyptian costume, you know, handling this bull. Joan is like so excited. Nelitha is all excited because her new love, the Pharaoh, has knocked off the bull. Now they're showing a scene where it's a party, and there's all kinds of cool things. There's African dancers, people from various parts of the Middle East putting on a show. This was actually true. They did do this. They invited people to come from all over the world to dance and to entertain the Pharaoh. I mean, they didn't have cable, so they had to do something fun. So they had all these dancers and singers and people from all over the world that would travel. It's written in many different things, not only in Egyptian, but in cuneiform and in other languages, Sanskrit, that there were these traveling entertainers. So I'm happy to see this too. A lot of these things will show people that don't know anything about Egypt in a realistic, glimpse. So that was kind of cool. So the movie, calling itself The Land of the Pharaohs, is accurate that way. I don't like the fact that they have an architect who's non-Egyptian building the pyramid. That's not true. And they mentioned other things. There's a scene earlier on where the heroes of the pyramid, the heroes of the war that the Pharaoh is doing, are buried with honors. That's also true. Then they show traitors, and they're thrown on a huge hill wall. They're thrown to the crocodiles. I'm sorry to say a lot of those things also happened. They were beheaded. They were drawn and quartered, and they were thrown. There is Subek, the crocodile god, and these people would have been made as sacrifices to Sobek, which is not a nice thing, but it is true. It's accurate that they would do such things. Early Egyptian culture was quite violent. Well, they all were, but this was very barbaric. And here you've got people that invented writing and learned about medicine and were very devout in their religion, but they had this odd other side to them that was extremely violent and cruel, I would think. I know that even your ancient Greeks did that. After all, Agamemnon sacrificed his daughter Iphigenia, did he not, before going on to the great quest for Helen of Troy, the Trojan War? His
Iphigenia, Calchas the seer, said that the gods demanded the death of Iphigenia, who was the daughter of Agamemnon.
And later.
He was kind of fined, because if he didn't sacrifice his daughter, the Greeks were already grumbling and wanted to leave. So he had to do that to show that he too was experiencing the wrath of the gods, and that he had to appropriate his leader.
And then later, his other daughter, Electra, and his wife, Clytemnestra, got back at him. when he came back, she killed him. It was a messy thing. She was very angry with him. You know, and then Elektra, I think Elektra kills Clytemnestra, doesn't she?
She kills some of the family and with her brother, their exile later on. He's confounded by Furies until he goes on trial in Athens and he's absolved by Athena, I believe.
I mean, it's a whole crazy thing. And, you know, I'm watching it. I'm watching, again, back to Joan Collins. She is very much coveting the jewels of the pharaoh. And she has, of course, this sexy guard who she's kind of looking at so she can seduce him to get him to give her what she wants. So she has a collar she's putting on that goes a huge black, I guess it's black tourmaline collar full on her. Everything looked beautiful on her. I've always been a fan. Everybody knows I'm crazy over Liz Taylor, but Joan Collins also one of, all my life, Joan Collins was also one of my favorites. She was one of the coolest villains on Batman called Cyrene. The next movie after this one was The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing, and she's very beautiful in that movie. It's about a battle between Sanford White, and I can't think of the other guy's name, but they fell in love with this girl, whose name was Evelyn Dawes. She appears on top of, she's in a gold statue of Diana on top of the Carnegie Hall, and she's still there. A replica of the statue is in the Metropolitan Museum. But this Evelyn Dawes posed for the statue, and she caused all kinds of, you know, hell between these two men. And one of them actually shot the other in the gardens on 14th Street. There was a great beer garden, and he shot him over Evelyn Dawes. So Joan Collins has been causing men wild havoc for almost, you know, 60 years. Now, you know, 2 or 3 days ago was her birthday. Joan is 90 years old now.
Wow.
She's had quite a legacy, and she's still very, very beautiful. I mean, yes, I'm sure, like anything else that's a well, like Liz Taylor said, if you have a diamond, you have to keep it polished or it won't shine. They were asking her about plastic surgery, and I'm sure Joan did the same thing. At 90 years old, you know, she looks probably more like she's in her 50s. She's quite beautiful. And it's an amazing thing. Everybody knows her, I guess, the zenith of her career took place on TV. Of course, that was Dynasty. If it wasn't for Joan, I don't think America would have had, or the world would have had, such great shoulder pads that we did in the 80s. All those women suddenly had Joan Crawford shoulders. Joan Crawford started that in the 40s. Joan Collins took it under her, I guess, over her wing, I guess, and made that a sensation. Every woman in the 80s had gigantic shoulder pads because they wanted to look like Alexis Carrington.
So you, as high priest of all things Egyptian, can make her a demigoddess because she obviously was that cinematically.
Oh, my God, yes. Everybody did. And that's an interesting thing, what one does. And you'll see it in all Egyptian tombs and temples. A pharaoh's image was put into the tomb. And written upon it will be sacred words and prayers saying that the gods, the other gods and goddesses will welcome our servant into heaven as the Lord or Lady of eternity. This is true. We see it very clearly in the tomb of Ramses II, his father Seti, Hatshepsut, and of course Tutankhamun. All of those tombs see the all praise to ye, Lord Pharaoh, keeper of the upper and lower regions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it deifies him. Now, you also see that to some extent in Rome, Caesar, Julius Caesar, Octavian, all of them were deified, Empress Livia by her grandson Claudius, were deified as gods, and they were worshipped as gods. I don't know. Was that done also in Greece? I'm thinking of Perseus.
Alexander the Great was recognized as a god during his own lifetime. And he had people writing about him. And it led to all sorts of questions as to how mythical the ancient accounts were, as opposed to being memories of kings that had lived before, whose lives had inspired the mythology.
I know that they found... I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Hercules.
No, Evemeros, or Euhemerus, as he's pronounced in English, he wrote about that extensively, about how people can become gods during their own lifetimes.
I know that they found... They believe it was the gold mask of Agamemnon, who was,
yes,
you know, given a tomb. And he was also that way deified. And what I love about that is that mask verifies and makes true the whole Trojan War. Because there he is, Agamemnon, he brought in the Trojan War. And there he is, buried. He's got a mask, he's buried. I was surprised they didn't do what they usually did, which was cremate him. But maybe they did, and they put. But I don't think so. I know that he was buried. And Alexander the Great was buried in his Alexandria, which is, of course, in Egypt. I always thought there, too, that Alexander the Great should have been buried in Athens, which was the city he considered the most educated in the whole world. But he was buried in Alexandria. I understand in this that. A very splendid gold and crystal, clear crystal porch and alabaster tomb. Then they said that even Julius Caesar went to that tomb and cried. He was, you know, taken back by how beautiful the tomb was, and that, you know, did great honors. Julius Caesar wanted to complete Alexander's mission. He wanted to make the world a better place. So they say. My readings of Julius Caesar say to me that he was more of an ambitious business warrior, and kind of like, and I forgive the words, but almost like a mafia king. He had a gang, including Mark Antony, that they were kind of vicious and rude. They weren't as noble as history later painted them, but new information has been brought forth that says, you know, he was kind of a mob king, I'll put it that way, like a Gotti. He was that kind of a man, really. So that's different. Alexander, on the other hand, did wonderful things, they say. But he also destroyed a lot of the nations he came in contact with. You know about Persepolis. When he got to Persia, he burned the city. He did marry the queen, but he burned the city. And that's not very cool. But getting back to my movie, so... Now, in order for all these people to be building the inside of the tomb, they have to be blindfolded.
We have around a minute and a half left, just to let you know.
Okay, so let's go there. What happens is Joan Collins gets buried in the tomb for trying to steal the jewelry. And everybody else that built the tomb were also killed. And it's a very, very strange, weird ending because there are all these salt things and sand things that are traps, so that when the tomb starts to close, all of these people will be suffocated to death, to be joining the Pharaoh, as I said, in eternity. So it's a very interesting movie. Some of it's right, some of it's not right.
Thank you very much. You've added another dimension to a review of the film given by the scholar. How can people contact you?
I want them to contact me through Michael K. Waterman on Facebook. You can friend me or ask questions. On Facebook also is my Phone a Wizard, which is the my business. You will have all my services that I will speak to you about. I'm sorry. You can reach me at mkwaterman@icloud.com. You can reach me on my phone, 516-650-3691, or of course you can reach me right here through Hercules Invictus, and it's always my pleasure to serve all.
And it's our pleasure to have you on. Thank you again for your encyclopedic knowledge of all things Kemetic, and I look forward to future conversations in this area. And thanks to our wonderful audience, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you dial the number and you're waiting in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later in demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Thanks for being here. Thanks again, Sedna.